everybody. The House State Affairs Committee will please come to order. Please take the roll.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Here.
Representative Tallarico.
Here.
Representative Stute.
Here.
Representative Keller.
Here.
Representative Vasquez. Representative Grunberg. Chair Lynn.
Here. And again, good morning, everybody. Today we will be considering three bills, SCR 6, the Sexual Assault Awareness Month, April 2015, HB 160, repeal art and public places requirement, HB 117, we've already heard, sexual assault examination kits. And with that, we're going to begin, please, with SCR 6, Sexual Assault Awareness Week. The presenter, please come forward. And Mr. Vice Chair, I beg your pardon. This is as is. Okay. Good morning, gentlemen. Please identify yourself and present this bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Edra Morledge, staff to Senator Meyer. He wanted to be here this morning, but something unexpected arose, and so he's spending his time elsewhere right now. Senate Concurrent Resolution 6 proclaims April 2015 as Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and it's part of an annual campaign to raise public awareness about sexual assault and educate communities and individuals on how to prevent sexual assault and violence across the nation. Sexual violence is a very serious public health problem that affects millions of women and men, and the CDC reports that in the United States, 1 in 5 women and 1 in 71 men have experienced violent sexual assault in their lifetime. In Alaska, however, those rates are much higher, and in fact, they're about 2.5 times the national average. Statistics often underestimate the problem because many victims don't tell the police, family, or friends about the violence that may be occurring. Sexual violence impacts health in many ways and can lead to long-term physical and mental health problems. And by bringing awareness to the crime of sexual assault and recognizing the enormity of the problem, can we then begin to address it, heal from it, and prevent it? SCR 6 is a small but significant step in educating the public and our communities and lifting the veil of secrecy that so often hides these horrific crimes. That concludes my presentation. The sponsor thanks you for your support, and I know we have a couple of folks here who are subject matter experts that could speak to the details of the bill.
Thank you, and Senator Mars, for bringing this bill forward. It's a small step towards solving a huge problem.
Yes.
So, any questions from the committee? Well, I can't read this with my bad eyes.
That's Peggy Brown.
Peggy Brown, are you online or in the audience? Good morning. Please identify yourself and give us your testimony.
My name's Peggy Brown. I'm the executive director for the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, which is comprised of 20 victim service agencies around the state. In consideration of the committee's time, I'll be exceedingly brief. I just wanted to thank the sponsor and thank this committee for looking at Sexual Assault Awareness Month, SCR 6. The programs are very appreciative. As you know, they're doing a lot of work out in the across the state. And we know we have a problem in the state with sexual assault and sexual abuse of minors, but there are some really good people out there doing some really good work helping those victims and survivors. So thank you for this bill.
What is the biggest problem in reducing sexual violence? I mean, where do we start on this thing? People, I assume, are maybe reluctant to report it and so on. What's the two or three things that we might do to help address the problem a little better than we are now?
That's a good question, Mr. Chairman. I have two or three things I can say briefly. One is prevention, prevention, prevention. We have got to be in the schools. We've got to be out in the Anywhere that children and young adults are, there has to be prevention programming around sexual violence prevention, how to thwart it, and that includes men, young men, boys, girls, everybody. So we have to do that. And we also have to, I think, look at ways we can improve the way we do things criminally. I know that in 2012, there were 804 reported cases of sexual assault. Of those 804, 8% resulted in some type of conviction. And, you know, that sends a message to people, why should I report? And quite honestly, I've asked friends of mine, some who have worked in the Department of Law and who are attorneys and work in the legal system, paralegals, and I asked them, like, if you were sexually assaulted, would you report? And, you know, 8 out of 10 of them say no, because they just don't want to have to go through the long process. You know, in
so the person gets victimized twice.
Yeah, and you know, people just want to kind of move on. They want to catch the bad guy. They want the bad guy to, or whoever, to be caught, but they also want their lives to move on. So I think if we can shorten the time that we address, you know, a criminal case, and if we really put some investment towards prevention work in the sexual violence, I think we are seeing actually changes just in the past 5 years, a slow reduction in teen sexual violence. We can actually show that number with some results. So those are the two or three things I would suggest.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee? Not again, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, we have Laura Moulton. Morton, I beg your pardon. Are you
in? Questions.
Okay, thank you. Okay, anybody online to testify? Anybody else in the audience to testify? I'll close public testimony, bring it to the committee. Any discussion in the committee? Okay, Mr. Vice Chair, I'll entertain a motion.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move SCR 6, that's version W, LS-0383W, out of committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Okay, any objection? Without objection, the bill passes. Again, thank you. And Senator Myers, we're bringing this bill forward. Looking forward to voting on it on the House floor. Our next bill to consider this morning is HB 160, repeal art in public places requirement. And I believe we have, a new CS needs to be adopted. Mr. Vice Chair?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move that we put in front of us for consideration the CS for House Bill 160, which is version H, hotel.
Thank you. Without objection, that is adopted. Would the presenter please come forward and identify yourself, please, and at the beginning, tell us the modifications that were made in the CS. And we're blessed this morning to have two Lynns present. Or something.
Thank you, Chairman Lynn. With that in mind, my name is Representative Lynn Gaddis. I represent District 7, the Greater Wasilla area, and I'm here to talk about House Bill 160, and I'll talk about the change. Between 2004 and 2013, the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, the Department of Education and Early Development, and the Alaska court system spent a combined total of $9,129,581 on art program expenditures. There are two parts to HB 160 work draft version H. And the first part enacts a 5-year moratorium on the 1% funding for art in public places, which would start July 1st, 2015, and end on July 1st, 2020. The second part enacts a sunset date on the Artworks in Public Buildings and Facilities Statute, as well as Art in Public Places Fund. The original bill did not discuss the moratorium, and when I spoke to the Arts Council, they wanted some time to become self-sufficient, recognizing that the goal of this bill was to no longer fund the 1% for arts. And so the compromise of giving that five-year moratorium, not funding, but allowing the Art Council to sell some artwork, lend some artwork, so on and so forth, to become self-sufficient. So that's where the written five-year moratorium, and then where it sunsets. If I could, I believe that I read it backwards, Mr. Chair, and I apologize. Version A of House Bill 160 repealed all the statutes that required 1% funding for art in public buildings and facilities, as well as amended other statutes that had references to the 1% for arts. Version H changes HB 160, that requirement for 1% funding for art in public buildings and facilities, and puts a moratorium on for 5 years, starting July 1, 2015 to July 1, 2020. Version H also includes a sunset date for the art in public buildings and facilities statutes found in AS 35.27, as well as Art in Public Places Fund. And quite frankly, the reason why I brought this bill forward, we're in a time where we can no longer afford to do some of these things that we really thought were nice at one time. Not that we don't value art, not that we don't value the artists that have participated. I certainly got a lot of feedback from artists, and in no way does it, am I saying that those artists should not continue their artwork and try to sell it. All this says is the state will no longer be sponsoring them in the same manner. And I am hoping that the Arts Council will become self-sufficient. So the reason that I'm working with them for that 5 years. So that's pretty much it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
How much currently we're putting 1% for the arts, and I see these pieces of art, how you describe it, you know, all over the place, and most of them are pretty good. But how much money would this put back into the mainstream to be used for other purposes in this time of fiscal shortages?
Mr. Chair, it would put 1% of the project.
Well, but in approximate dollars, how much more money would we have to spend for other things? And if you don't know the answer, that's...
Well, I guess... If you don't have a project, then you don't have any money for that 1% of that project. So if there isn't, and we are considering here in the legislature not funding capital projects, specifically schools at this time. So I would certainly say from the school standpoint that should the bills that are being talked about pass,
Right. Anything we don't spend on anything is going to
exactly.
go back.
I don't know how to say that.
It's going to go back in the general fund to be spent on other necessary things.
Right. So I guess I can only answer is whatever 1% of the project is, that's how much we'll save.
And just out of curiosity, how does one qualify to have their piece of art displayed? Is there a jury? We do this piece of art, or we do that piece of art. This is quote good art. This is bad art. Or is there? How do we determine what goes where? Make these judgments.
And Mr. Chair, I think it's different in different places. I certainly can respond how it has been done in the Mat-Su School District because I was on the school board at one time. And in our particular circumstance, there was art for Wasilla High, and the Wasilla Art Group and the Wasilla High principal chose that art, and that's how it was done through in that particular process.
And so people submit the art or description or drawings of the art, and then somebody decides?
Through that particular art program at Wasilla High, that's how they did it then. Also, while I sat on the school board, we also had Career Tech. I can remember that particular artwork actually coming through the school board, and we chose it through the school board. So I know that it's done in different ways in different communities.
Thank you.
In different ways in the same communities.
Any questions from the committee? Representing Colorico.
I appreciate this because I know that we do have some tough financial times. I guess the only thing that I want the sponsor to know is I'm a little bit torn by it due to the fact that the ones that I was involved in back in municipal government, all of our art was done by local artists and Alaska residents, every bit of it. So although I can see some savings, I also see the benefit in making sure that Alaskan artists have, it's not a huge part, but it is part of their market. That's just, so I'm struggling a little bit here.
Representative Gaddis.
And through the chair, Representative Tallarico, that's the very reason that I compromised with the Arts Council to try to help them become self-sufficient in the next 5 years, because it certainly was not my desire to take away from the local Alaskan artists, but rather just recognize that in our budgetary times that we no longer can afford for the state to do that, and there are other avenues, and the council indicates that they have some pretty creative ideas that they think they can become self-sufficient.
Very good. Any other questions? Okay. Just hang around there. I have in the audience.
Those are online there.
Okay, which is online?
They're both online, yeah.
Okay. I'm going to go to Nzima Marai, Municipality of Anchorage. Are you online?
And she's in the audience.
Oh, in the audience. Okay, if you're in the audience, is anybody out there? Zena, Marai, are either online or in the audience? Okay, I'll hold off on that one.
Hello?
Yes. Yes. Please identify yourself.
Hello, Mr. Chair. This is Zena Marai.
Yes, please identify yourself and tell us whom you represent and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, Mr. Chair. My name is Nzima Marari. Can you hear me?
Yes, again, a little louder, if you may. I just pull the microphone closer to you.
Hello, my name is Nzima Marari.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, very much better. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am the curator of the Public Art Program for the Municipality of Anchorage's 1% for Art Public Art Program. In over the 15 years that I've lived in Alaska, I have seen and personally known several individuals who have benefited from the public art program. It has awarded them opportunities for professional growth, development, financial sustainability, and exposure both locally and nationally. Additionally, I have seen our city and state benefit from having this program by gaining cultural, social, and economic value. Alaska was a pioneer in the national movement to integrate artwork into public buildings, having adopted the Public Art Statute in 1975. At this time, Alaska was one of only three states to do so. Losing this legacy would be a tremendous loss for our state and would have virtually no impact on the state's operating or capital budget. The 1% for art funds are taken directly from construction costs. If repealed, this small fraction of renovation or construction budgets would likely be reallocated to other construction expenses within each individual project and not serve to benefit the state's overall operating or capital budget. Public art is a distinguishing part of our public history and our evolving culture. It reflects and reveals our society, adds meaning to our cities, and uniqueness to our communities. The Percent for Art program enhances our public spaces by making them more accessible to individuals and by reflecting the culture of Alaska. The city of Anchorage and state of Alaska aspire to be places where people want to live and want to visit. Places with a strong public art expression gives community a stronger sense of place and identity. Public art reflects a community and cultural identity and creates public investment and pride in the city and the state. Alaskan artists will be negatively and severely impacted by the repeal of this statute. Public art commissions can play a significant role in the development and sustainability of an artist's career, and many Alaskan artists have been able to build a successful artistic business as a result of a public art commission. Funds from Percent for Art commissions also support fabricators, electricians, welders, engineers, and other skilled workers. The Percent for Art program can be an essential element to the city and state's economic progression and viability to our current and prospective citizens. According to the Americans for the Arts, cities with an active and dynamic cultural scene are more attractive to individuals and businesses. Further, public art can be a key factor in establishing a unique and culturally active place. Public art activates the imagination and encourages people to pay attention and perceive more deeply the environment they occupy. Public art stimulates learning and thought about art and society, about our interconnected lives, and about the social sphere as a whole. Public art is fully integrated into the community and our public spaces, encouraging a sense of shared ownership and collective affiliation. HB 160 would only serve to terminate a program that has positive social, cultural, and economic impacts for the state of Alaska. The Percent for Art program creates opportunities for Alaskans for financial, professional, and personal growth. Investing in the public art program helps to diversify our economy through recognition of the roles artists play as small business owners and the additional investment in local fabricators, electricians, welders, engineers, and others. Public art transforms Alaska into a place that has accessible cultural and social significance and is an ever-changing and progressing environment where people want to live, work, and play. The Percent for Art program invests in Alaska and encourages communities and individuals to do the same. I urge you to reject HB 160. The Percent for Art program helps to make a place where Alaskans want to stay. It creates opportunities for professional, personal, and financial growth for Alaskan artists. It cements Alaska as a vibrant cultural and social environment. And lastly, HB 160 will not impact the state's overall operating or capital budgets, as Percent for Art funds are specifically allocated to construction budgets and would likely be reallocated to other construction expenses within each individual project. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I've been asked to have, for the record, have you spell your name first and last, please.
First name, E as in Echo, N as in Nancy, V as in Zed, I, N as in Nancy, A. Last name, M as in Man, A, R, R, A, R, I.
A, R, I?
Correct.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions for the testifier? I'd like to point out that my colleague, Reverend Gernberg, has now joined us.
I apologize.
No, not necessary. Oh, and would you please, I've also been asked to have you mail your testimony.
Email.
Email your testimony to us. And again, this bill is not for or against art. The bill is actually a moratorium on 1% for the art, but it's not anti-art. Shannon Doubt, are you online or
someplace? Yes, I am. Good morning.
Good morning. Please identify yourself and give us your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Shannon Doubt. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska State Council on the Arts. Thank you for your time this morning. I want to speak briefly about this program and its importance in the state. As Anzina noted, this legislation was passed in 1975. We were the third state in the country. At that time, we as a state were only 16 years old, and we were pioneering this movement
of integrating public art into public buildings, which came out of the brutalist architecture of the 50s and 60s, which were the concrete government buildings. People realized that we wanted to create a more open, accessible environment for people to interact in public spaces, and the Percent for Art program does just that. We, through those years, have developed an incredible collection of assets that reflect our cultural history, and these assets are the only part of construction budgets that appreciate over time. These assets are very important to our state. I want to talk about the role that this program plays for artists. Whether we're talking about a repeal or a moratorium, this will have a devastating impact on Alaskan artists. We, in the past 5 years, 66 Alaskan artists have been commissioned for Percent for Art pieces in public buildings throughout the state. Public art is a critical piece of the ecosystem in which artists can develop their business, their businesses and their professional careers. Many artists we've heard from after their first commission have gone on to build very successful businesses. Ray Troll, an artist in Ketchikan, is one that describes his first commission as a game changer. He now has a very successful business in Ketchikan. This is a very, very critical part of the way that artists can make a living. It is incredibly difficult for artists to make a living anywhere, but especially in Alaska. And we work with our artists to help them develop the business skills that they need to be successful. When we're looking at ways that we need to diversify our economy, I encourage you to think of ways that the creative economy can play an important and significant role in helping to diversify our revenue streams for the state. Artists are willing and eager to grow and to help improve Alaska while also improving our financial picture, improving our quality of life as well. Just briefly, the question of the process came up, and I'll just outline briefly the national standard that we adhere to when we do Percent for Art commissions. The project manager from usually DOTPF, the architect, members of the community, and an artist are all on the selection committee. Artists submit examples of previous work, and those are reviewed by the committee, and finalists are selected and then paid a stipend to develop a proposal for a site-specific work, much like architects, much like other types of contractors and capital construction projects. The committee then identifies the finalist and commissions the artist. It's a very solid process. It's very community engaged. The community has input into the type of work they want, where they want it cited. It's a very, very solid and respected process.
Thank you very much.
We understand that this... Excuse me?
Oh, I thought you had concluded. I'm sorry.
Okay. No worries. You know, we understand the budget situation that we're facing, and I think all of us are feeling like we're in this together, but this moratorium would disproportionately cut the arts and the artists. You know, the Percent for Art program is designed to contract when the capital budgets shrink. It's kind of built in the cake. And putting a moratorium forward would disproportionately affect our state's artists as they are working to expand their careers and diversify the revenue of the state of Alaska. I encourage you to not support this bill, and thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. In your testimony, you said this is part of the ecosystem, I guess it would be.
Correct.
Can you explain? I thought it had to do with like natural resources and, you know, say the animals and so on. Art is part of the ecosystem. Could you explain that, please?
Absolutely. So artists have to be quite wily in creating a career for themselves as independent sole proprietorships. Within this ecosystem, there are a variety of different things that help artists move forward. Some of it is professional development. Some of it is gallery sales and gallery representation, working in schools with children, which our agency also supports. There are a variety of different ways that artists can build a career, also teaching at universities or in schools, and public art is a very significant component of that. because of financially, that's one piece of it. And within each of these projects, they hire contractors and fabricators and welders and different people involved in the process. But often, going through the process of a public commission, they are able to really hone their skills and have a greater level of sophistication in which they approach their business. And then lastly, the public art commissions can really help gain exposure for artists nationally and internationally. Our public art collection is award-winning nationally as well. So these can be huge boons for artists. There are artists that get their first commission in Alaska and go on to get other commissions outside of Alaska. So they're being supported by funds outside of the state as well. And this is a game changer for a lot of artists.
Thank you very much. That's a definition of ecosystem that I'm familiar with. But thank you for your testimony. Is Ann Coates McGrath, are you online?
Yes, I'm here.
Please introduce yourself and give us your testimony. Tell us whom you said you represent yourself here.
Yes, my name is Ann Coates McGrath, and I grew up here in Anchorage, and I am a graphic designer and an artist. I grew up in a very rich cultural community, very inspiring. I experienced firsthand a number of the works by Native artists, and also grew up hearing the legends associated with some of the imagery and being inspired by these things. All of this inspired me to ultimately become an artist. And my mother, Pam Coates, was also very involved in the Percent for Arts program here in Anchorage. So, I have been away from Anchorage for many years. I went to design school in L.A., Art Center College of Design, lived there for many years, went on to New York City, and returned here just a few years ago with my husband, also from Anchorage, because we wanted our daughter to grow up in what we thought of as not only beautiful from a natural standpoint, but a culturally rich community. And, I was always very proud. I like to say the difference between my experience of L.A., which took me a long time to warm up to, and my experience of New York, where I was for a shorter time, is that L.A. has a lot of walls, a lot of separation. People drive in their cars, they're in their houses, they're not out in public. And what I like about New York is that you see everyone and everyone sees you. You see them on the subways. There's a kind of access and a community spirit. And that's something that I think public art provides, in that anyone can have access to it and see it and be inspired by it. And I think art and artists tell stories in a way that is beyond the reach of our common language. And I became a graphic designer because it seemed to be the practical way to practice my art. But even in the commercial realm, it's becoming increasingly difficult to earn a good living because of things like crowdsourcing, and that's another matter. But I think it's so important to provide children with access to art, even if their parents aren't deeply involved. And those children, some of them go on to become artists, but some of them go on to become architects, and some go on to become designers, and to impact the world in very positive ways. As a designer, I was part of a project. We went to Accra, Ghana, to interview people who didn't have phones. I worked for a multinational telecommunications company for a long time, and that our purpose was to see if we could design a phone, an affordable phone, so that they could connect, so that they could support their businesses and connect with their families, people who couldn't afford cell phones. And so I just think that the importance of art, my mother raised with me. She sent me a photo of my daughter, who's now three, embracing one of the public statues in front of the museum, climbed up on top of it, and I showed it to her this morning. She was two at the time, and she recognized it immediately, and I said, "Do you remember where this was taken?" "Yes, it's a museum." And I just think that it's essential to our community, and I'd be very disappointed to see that rich cultural element be hampered in any way. And I think that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Going to go to Fairbanks now. Kessler Woodward, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you just fine. Please identify yourself and give your testimony.
Thank you so much. My name is Kessler Woodward. I live in Fairbanks. My testimony will be slightly different than I had planned for it to be this morning with the last-minute introduction of the committee substitute. And I will be speaking because of that, not in my capacity as vice chair of the Alaska State Council on the Arts, and someone who has served for most of the last 3.5 decades on the Alaska State Council on the Arts, appointed by 4 governors and retained and reappointed by 2 others. I will be speaking today solely as an individual and as the president of the Alaska Arts and Culture Foundation, a wholly independent not-for-profit. I want to fervently urge this committee not to be lulled into thinking the substitute of a 5-year moratorium, the Alaska Percent for Art legislation, will have any other effect than to kill this highly successful important program, just as surely as outright appeal. Every argument we've provided and that you've heard from people all over the state regarding the value of the program, regarding its self-regulating nature, that is, that little or no spending on art will be made in times of small or existent or non-existent capital budgets, is exactly the same in regard to this substitute. And a moratorium, just as a repeal, would have no positive impact on state budgets. I've always been proud of the fact that 40 years ago, when we were a young and vigorous and visionary state, Alaska became the 3rd state in the country to adopt a percent for art law. More than half the states in America now have thriving programs of this sort. I have to say that testifying in opposition to this bill and the substitute today, I have a sense of what Yogi Berra famously called deja vu all over again. Over the last 4 decades, legislation's been proposed several times to repeal this law, mostly by individual legislators who didn't like 1 or 2 of the artworks commissioned either there in Juneau or in their own communities. Each time we've succeeded in explaining that it's not the State Arts Council or some elite group of artists who chose those works, but committees made up primarily the users of the state buildings themselves, and that the vast majority of the artworks commissioned through the program are much beloved by the people who work in and those who visit the buildings in which they're installed. In the course of these discussions over the last 4 decades, of course, the question of the program's cost to the state has been raised each time. And each time we've successfully explained that the repeal of this legislation would not save the state any money. The statute simply requires that 1% of existing state capital construction budgets be used for art in those buildings, just as those budgets cover design, engineering, windows, lighting, flooring, ventilation, and the like. Repealing this law will not lower the cost of state buildings. All it will do is impoverish our built environment. Once again this week, the State Arts Council and others have provided compelling testimony on these facts. Once again, artists from throughout Alaska have sent you messages saying how important this program, which requires no state funding on top of existing capital construction budgets, is to their livelihood, and how proud they are to be able to contribute to the quality of life for all Alaskans. I fervently ask you today not to end this program. The repeal or a 5-year moratorium on which would have no impact on the state budget and which for 40 years has so enriched our state and our lives. Thank you.
Thank you very much for testimony. I have a question, I believe, from Vice Chair Keller.
Yeah, thank you, Kessler. You and several testifiers have made the comment this has absolutely no effect on operating or capital budget. And I want to say before I ask my question that I also deeply appreciate the value of art, how it enriches us in so many ways, and it's you know, it's really nice to have it around on public buildings. But it just escapes me how you could say that it doesn't affect the budget when it is money being spent. Maybe you could run through that logic one more time. It's public money. that is currently being spent, and I understand that it isn't all state revenue. A lot of it is local revenue, but it's money being spent, and then we reimburse the state for many of these projects, you know, like the school projects we do. And I just seems to me like that goes too far to just declare blanket that it has no effect. And I also have another question, if you I'll let you respond to that first.
Yes, sir, I'd be happy to respond to that. State buildings cost what they cost. The allocations are made in the capital construction budget, and those figures are set. The percent, 1% is not added on top of that capital construction budget in order to buy art. Art comes out of that budget just like everything else. It's a very small 1%. It's a half of a percent for rural schools. And it goes for the same things that the rest of the construction budget goes for the design and the engineering and the outfitting of those buildings. If this 1% were not spent on art, it would be spent on another few windows, another kind of flooring, another bathroom or two. That's why we keep saying, and why we have made the case over the years very successfully, that eliminating this program won't save any money, is that it's a false belief to think that this building will cost 1% less if we repeal this program. The building will end up costing just the same.
I have a construction background, and I build houses, and if there's a 1% requirement on the cost, I would assume, and I'm sure this is true, that this is all operated on a bid system, and that does have the impact on the bids ultimately. So again, it just leaves me a little bit puzzled on this. But another thing is, you said, I believe, confirm this or not, but I think you said 40 other states have similar programs now on this. Do you know, or did you look at whether they're all state-sponsored programs?
What I said was that just over half the states in the country now have a program of this sort. There are, I think, 26, the last time I looked, states which have percent for art programs which mandate a small percentage of funding be included for state-funded buildings.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony, sir. excuse me, June Rogers. And are you online, Ms. Rogers? Are you? I can't hear you.
She's in the Fairbanks, Ohio. She should be
online. Okay. And while we're waiting.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you fine. Just 1 second, please. I have a bill up at another committee in the Senate, and so I'm going to turn the gavel over in just a couple of moments to my Vice Chair, Representative Keller. And before I leave, I would state that I do support HB 160 and hope we can move it out of the committee. So, again, thank you for your upcoming testimony, Ms. Rogers, and at this point I'm going to turn the gavel over to my Vice Chair, Representative Keller.
Okay, June, if you would, identify yourself for the record and go right ahead.
My name is June Rogers. I'm Executive Director for the Fairbanks Arts Association, and I'm greatly concerned about the outcomes of HB 160, even with the changes represented in version H. I understand the dire circumstances that are before all of our esteemed legislators, and I am grateful for their pursuit of budget solutions. However, I cannot support the advancement of this bill. The economics of such a decision doesn't hold up to scrutiny. Repealing the act would not bring new dollars to the budget, but rather the 1% would be reallocated to other costs in each individual capital project's budget. When investing state dollars in public art, or enhancements as many artworks are called, it's important to have an accurate understanding of the result that expected. Artists are a significant segment of a community's diversity of economics, and their work is integral to the advancement of both their own small business ventures and those of their suppliers. As constructors and craftsmen,
It's interesting to note that the art incorporated in a public building is generally the only part of that building to appreciate and value. That's something to think about. The development of small business is in no small measure one of the most important developments of our economy. Small businesses are the backbone of our communities, and it is dangerous to make decisions about which segment of our economy is expendable. As a point of pride in the history of a rugged and determined people, I'd like to remind that in 1975, Alaska was one of the earliest states to adopt the percent for art statute. This is not an unusual stance for Alaska. Fairbanks was home to an opera company and other notable art in the early 1900s, and people were known to pack pianos over Chilkoot Pass. Working together is heralded as being one of the surest methods of building successful, healthy communities. I'd like for us to work together to find reliable sources of savings that devastate, as there are indeed areas of excess that can and perhaps should have been cut before we were compelled to reckon with the current budget problems. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you. Please do not advance HB 160. I firmly oppose this bill, even with the changes represented in version H. Thank you.
Thank you, June. Any questions? I don't see any questions for you, so thank you for taking time to testify. We'll go now. I don't think there's anybody else online, so we'll go in the room here. Nancy, is it the attorney? Nancy, if you would, identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Hi. My name is Nancy DeCherney. I'm the executive director for the Juno Arts and Humanities Council. And as you may sort of guess, I oppose this bill. I want to commend, and I really want to express my appreciation for all of you for this really tough time that you're working through. And understand that I would do what I can to help you with that sort of stuff. I want to make sure, and I think some questions have come forward as to whether or not we actually save any money by eliminating the percent for art or even putting a moratorium on the percent for art, simply because it is a percentage of something that if there is no, a percent of zero is still zero. Also, I want to observe that public art, I think, I don't know that there's been any analysis of the income that we actually see from having public art in our airports and in our public buildings. This building itself is a source of tourist destination. A lot of it has to do with the history here, but also the building is beautiful and has pieces of art. I think our this is going to sound really silly, but I took a class or a seminar at the Americans for the Arts Public Art Network. The fountain, the Trevi Fountain in Rome, was originally a public works piece for this water system. And it's sort of paid for itself, I would say, over the years. And I think that we should look at that. The business of jobs has come forward, the amount of work that is developed for local artists. I know in Juno we are working very hard to make Juno a center for Northwest Coast art. This won't necessarily directly affect it, but I think it sends a message. I think all of us are working hard to use the arts in a creative, economic fashion. So I would hope that when you're considering this, you don't just think about the bit that we might save over a period of time, but also think about what we might lose over a period of time by not having art invested in our public. I guess that's all I want to say.
Well, thank you very much. I see no questions at this time, but thanks for testifying. So, is there anybody else in the room that would like to testify on HB 160? And nobody else online, so we're going to close public testimony at this time. And that brings it before the committee for discussion or action. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I probably should put on the record that my stepfather, who raised me, was an artist. Jacques Schneer was his name. He was the first full professor of sculpture at Cal. and his artwork appears all over the Bay Area, and even we have some in Alaska in front of various buildings, at least one. He's dead now. I have no financial interest in this, but I have a spiritual interest, and my view has been expressed by the folks who have weighed in against this bill, and with due respect for the author of the bill, sponsor, and for the folks on the other side, I can't support the bill. And I won't take the committee's time because it's been eloquently, the reasons against the bill have been eloquently stated. But I will be opposing the movement of the bill, and I will be opposing the bill in any form it appears on the floor. Thank you.
Any other discussion? Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also have concerns about the bill, although, you know, appreciate the intent and motivation of the sponsor, given the climate we're in. But I feel this would be, you know, looking in the wrong direction, basically, for a couple of reasons. And as Representative Tallarico, I think kind of got at, you know, with 1% for the art, you've got these very, very small commissions going out, being parceled out to local artists. And in our economy, I'm not sure there are more scrappy economic art economic actors than independent artists who are eking out a living, you know, $5,000 at a time, or selling prints for a couple $100, or giving lessons. And so, not only does all this money stay local, it stays ultra-local, and it recirculates and circulates and creates, I think, a huge amount of activity proportional to the relatively small amount of money that we're talking about. So, you know, in the economic sense, I think you get sort of a huge return from a very small investment. Second, I was talking with someone else in this building a few weeks ago about the University of Alaska system, and you know, it's been, you know, he very much loves the university, but it's sort of been a long-standing mission of his that, you know, the University of Alaska should be the University of Alaska, and we should do everything we can to make sure that if the University of Alaska were, you know, compared to the University of Kansas, that you could actually tell the difference, and that there would be programming at the University of Alaska that really speaks to what we have in Alaska, whether it's, you know, Arctic engineering or geophysics or cold climate housing research, whatever it might be. And with buildings in Alaska, schools, public facilities, anything, you know, I, at least for me as a partisan Alaskan, I think it's really important that the places we live in and work in don't look like buildings you could just find in Kansas or Ohio. Nothing against Kansas or Ohio. And I think at least, you know, the schools that I went to school in growing up in Sitka and around Alaska, the 1% for Art program, I think, really effectively differentiated and gave us a sense of place and identity, and maybe accounted for the patriotism I now feel for our state. So I have a strong connection to this program, having grown up around it, and I think benefited from it indirectly as a person. Again, I know where the sponsor is coming from, but like my colleague from East Anchorage, have concerns about advancing it.
Yeah, I'm going to comment that this, unfortunately, some of the comments, you know, make it look like this is a vote for or against art. And that puts everybody in a really bad spot. And to me, the question is not art or not, it's whether or not we're going to subsidize art from the state level. And I know that it has been portrayed as not a subsidy, but rather just this innocent requirement that 1% extra be spent on public buildings. But to me, it translates out to subsidy. So that's where I'm coming from. But barring any other comments, what I'm going to do is set the bill aside, and we'll let the chair decide whether to bring the vote forward or not. So, Representative Grunberg?
I'd just like to, I'm sorry, when I spoke before, I didn't mention a couple of others, folks that I've been associated with. I can just have a moment to make my comment again. I mean, some things I didn't say, if I could just have a moment.
We typically don't give two bites of the apple, but that's fine. We have plenty of time. You go right ahead.
It's a big apple.
Okay.
My former brother-in-law, Skip Wallen, is a well-known local artist, and if you look across the street at the Bear, he did that, and he's doing the Whale, and he did the Bears out at DIPAC. And those are, I'm not sure how the Whale is going to be financed, whether there's any public funds in that. But that kind of thing will go away, and the reason I'm saying that is because everybody in Juneau sees those things on a daily basis. And imagine, even before that they had Nimbus, which we can smile about, but it was there. The point being, it was there. Anyway, that, I just wanted to make that, and I wanted to serve notice that I won't be offering any amendments or anything like that. We can have an up and down vote, and I don't know how you want to proceed. I have no objection if you want to take the vote now, whatever you want.
Yeah, no, thank you, Mr. Representative Grunberg. What we'll do is wait for the chair. He may bring it up later in the process, but for now we're going to put HB 160 aside, and we're moving to 117. If we would, Representative Stutz, if you would move, we have a new CS provided here by the committee, and we want it up for consideration. So if you'd move that for consideration, I'd appreciate it.
I would move, Mr. Chair, I would be happy to. I move the new CS for House Bill 117 version E that we adopted as our working document.
So without objection, Echols is on the table for our discussion. We make sure everybody, please,
if
you have that version, we'll take an at ease to make sure everybody has version Echo in front of us, and yeah. Representative Grunberg has a question for the sponsor.
My question is, what was the previous version that was before us? Was it the A version, or was there something in between?
Good morning, members of the committee. Thank you for having us back. The previous version was the W version.
W.
That was what was under consideration, and when we get into it, we can explain the version E that we'll be looking at this morning.
Representative Tarr, if you would identify yourself for the record and give us the explicit changes between version Echo and version W.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Representative Garen Tarr from Anchorage, serving House District 19, joined by Ray Friedlander, my staff person here working on this legislation. Want to thank the committee for the thoughtful consideration last week and the lengthy discussion. There were a couple of points brought up during that time, during the discussion, and what we did in the time between these two meetings was work with the chair's office as well as Rep. Vasquez's office to address some of their suggestions and thoughts, and those changes are reflected here in the version E committee substitute. So I'll let Ray describe those specific changes, and I think each person should have a sheet passed out to them with a summary.
We all have the sheet in front of us, so if you would, Ray, identify yourself for the record and go through it.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Ray Friedlander, staff to Representative Garen Tarr. We're looking at CSHB 117 version E, and the first change you'll note is on page 1, line 7. The previous CS had a July 1st, 2015 date, and that was changed to September 1st, 2015. So that's when each law enforcement agency and State Department charged with the maintenance, storage, and preservation of sexual assault examination kits shall conduct an inventory and then report the number to DPS. On page 1, line 13, September 1st, 2015 was the date in the former CS, and that was changed to November 1st, 2015. So that's when DPS will prepare and transmit a report to the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives that contains information on the kits, such as the number, the date, and a plan for addressing the backlog. And And these dates were changed just to provide more time for the 150 local law enforcement agencies to conduct the audit and DPS to produce the report.
And so before we go to the other changes, we just want to ask if there are any questions about those two changes with moving the dates and giving a little more time.
Any questions on the dates from the committee? Okay, please proceed.
So on page 2, lines 10 through 16, the definition of untested sexual assault examination kit was expanded to include the phrase with evidence, which you'll note on line 11. And that change occurred just because we want to make sure that the audit is specifically for kits that have evidence and not just kits that haven't been utilized by local law enforcement agencies and state departments. And in addition to that change, we've further elaborated on the definition to state that it's kits that not only have been collected but not submitted to the lab, but it's also kits that have been collected and submitted to the lab but not yet processed with DNA or serological testing. And like I said before, this is just to ensure that the audit only includes kits with evidence, and the expansion of the definition encompasses the crime lab. So the crime lab will also be included in the audit, in addition to the 150 local law enforcement agencies and other state departments charged with handling the untested sexual assault examination kits. Are there any questions?
Any questions from the committee? And I want to point out to the committee that we have Oren Dim from the lab online. We have Dean Williams from Public Safety. And then we have a couple that are want to testify. So no questions for the sponsor? Can you, just as a background to help us understand the bill a little bit more, can you give us the history of where the kits originally came from? I mean, who dreamt this up? And it's a, you know, it's a great idea, you know, and credit is due. I guess the real question in my mind is, I would assume the motivation for these kits was to be a tool that would be readily available for both medical and enforcement to ensure that rape gets properly investigated. But could you just give us a little bit of history?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This idea was actually brought to my attention by a national organization working, you know, throughout the country to address the issue of the backlog of untested rape kits. And the motivation is, you know, the thinking that there are perhaps violent criminals who are still out on the streets only because these kits haven't been processed, and so that, you know, the DNA hasn't been entered into a database that would associate them with that or another crime. And when I was reading up on this issue, then thinking about our high rates of domestic violence and sexual assault here, you know, we wanted to inquire into, you know, well, what's the situation in Alaska? Do we have a problem here? And the motivation with the legislation here today is just that this is the first step in answering that question and addressing whether we truly have a problem in Alaska. What has been surprising is that there isn't a uniform protocol with so many, you know, the 150 agencies involved in this process. And we just, you know, this is an opportunity, really, to get everybody on the same page and just coordinate that work better, make sure that it's we have a better understanding of what's happening, and also allow the state to perhaps seek additional resources. As we learned from Mr. Dim last week, there are about 170 rape kits right now at the crime lab that haven't been tested. And once we have this audit done, it might allow the state or help the state further in a process of seeking some outside funds to help with addressing that backlog. And it just, you know, when you think about, well, maybe just even one crime could be solved if we had this information in a more timely fashion. I thought Ms. Brown, when she was up for the earlier resolution on Sexual Assault Awareness Month, made some good points about the problems with, you know, sort of the whole process, and this is one piece of that process. And as she alluded to earlier, it can be so difficult for a victim to participate in the ongoing criminal procedures because of the length of time it takes for these cases to be processed and to be re-victimized on a continuing basis and have to relive that traumatic event can be you know, too much for an individual if they're trying to just sort of move on and pick up the pieces and go forward. And this is just one piece of that. And we think if we can bring expediency to the process, get these kits tested in a more timely fashion, process crimes more quickly, we could, you know, prevent someone like the individual who escaped from the Anchorage jail, who's known serial rapist, from being out on the streets. And that's the real motivation. So this is just the first step to get the audit done. We have been working closely with the department, and Mr. Williams didn't have a chance to testify last week, but is available on the phone this morning. They're enthusiastic about working on this because, you know, kind of getting everyone on the same page. I think everyone's kind of realizing, well, this could really help us move forward and, you know, be another tool in addressing the high rates of sexual assault in Alaska.
All right. What, have you thought, considered the fact that you're taking something, the rape kit, as I understand it, they're not standardized. They're different in every state. They vary from location to location. And it's completely there as a voluntary tool. It can be used, you know, kind of thing. Parts of it can be used. Mm-hmm. And have you thought about the fact that formalizing the process, what you just said you're trying to do, mm-hmm. may have an unintended consequence of not making these as easily available? See, if a medical personnel right now can reach up right and grab a kit off the shelf, mm-hmm. and use something out of it, if you formalize the process, there's a possibility that the medical personnel will say, shoot, I'm not going to open up one of those. That's paperwork. Mm-hmm. You know, have you considered that?
Thank you. That's a great question. Right now, once a kit is open and you're collecting evidence, there is a standardized process. Where there's not a standard process is what happens next in terms of whether that kit is, you know, put on an evidence shelf and just sits there for a long time until, you know, enough evidence is collected and the case moves forward, or whether that kit would always be sent in for testing. It's sort of the after the evidence has been collected, but I think the opportunity here with doing the audit is just identifying if there are sort of what are our best practices and helping us come up with a sort of a more standardized process for that, you know, so that there would be best practices. I think it would involve, you know, the public safety professionals, and if there was some piece of it that felt like it would, you know, hinder the process rather than help it, I think they'd be available to help avoid that from happening.
And the reason I asked the question is in the bill you use the term collected, and part of what is going to have to be done in this process of the audit is decide whether or not collected means that it is therefore evidence or what, you know. And so it is going, just your bill, even though it's just an audit, is mm-hmm. going to force things like that. The term collected is not defined in the bill, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering if to be honest, if it shouldn't be in here, rather than using it as a lever for reform, mm-hmm. Have you considered that?
Through the chair, or do you want to have something you want to add on that?
Yeah, Chair, I talked with Ledge Legal about that specific term, and so that's why they wanted to expand on it with evidence. So that was added specifically in there to address the collected. It's a kit that has been collected with evidence. I believe that was an amendment or an idea that Representative Vasquez had as well. And so talking or consulting with Ledge Legal, they felt that adding with evidence in line 11 addressed that collected bit.
Ray, that's great, and I really am grateful that you've looked at that. You know, as I read the definition, that was not clear to me. It said with evidence. If the definition stopped there, then I would understand it. You know, in other words, if you have a rape kit with evidence, yeah, let's get this thing tested. Let's quit the backlog. This is terrible, and I'm with you, 100%. But then you've got parts one and two, and it talks about that have been collected and has been collected and submitted. You know, I just wondered if there isn't, if that language is sufficient to do what you, maybe it's enough just to be talking about it on the record, but, you know, I just wanted to make sure it was on the table.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, because Mr. Williams is on the phone, you know, we've been working closely with them and sort of trying to get the right language together to, you know, result in the information that we want in the audit, and he may be able to address a little bit more of that for you.
Okay. Let's go directly then to Mr. Dim and see if he has, have you been listening and do you have input here, and then we'll also talk to Dean Williams for the Department of Public Safety. Just to see, my question, if you know, if you didn't get it, is do we need a definition of collected, or do we need to define the nexus between what is evidence and what is collected? Oren?
For the record, Mr. Vice Chair, my name is Oren Dim. I am the Forensic Laboratory Manager with the Alaska Scientific Crime Detection Laboratory, Department of Public Safety in Anchorage. In terms of the term collected, once a sexual assault kit is used for the collection of evidence, I find the meaning clear. I'm not certain that it needs any further clarification from that. Once the seals are broken and used to collect evidence, that is what we're looking at counting.
So, Oren, are you saying then that if a hospital uses a kit, that is automatically evidence there as far as you're concerned?
Mr. Vice Chair, that is correct. Once it's collected, it becomes evidence.
And that is that not, Oren, not the, I mean, maybe you don't have to answer this, but it's a question that's in my mind, and maybe you can shed some light on it. But is that not a new definition here? Because I was under the impression from what I heard from the last hearing that there was cases in enforcement where, you know, a piece might have been used out of the kit, and then the victim or alleged victim decided not to proceed. Therefore, you've got collected evidence that hasn't been processed properly by the state, and we really maybe perhaps, you know, exacerbated the problem we're trying to fix.
Mr. Vice Chair, I think you've hit on a key word there. There's a difference between evidence and whether or not it's going to be prosecuted. It doesn't change the fact that it's still evidence. Whether or not it's a prosecutable case, whether or not a victim wants to pursue it, has no bearing on the fact that it's still evidence collected from a crime scene.
Let me ask a question one more time, Oren, just to try to help me out. So right now you're saying there's evidence that is not being considered evidence because it is not forwarded? If a piece of the kit gets used, that is evidence as far as you're concerned. So that means public safety has to keep that in warehouse forever. And that's as my understanding is that that's not how the kits are really being used, but I could be wrong. I'm certainly not an expert in the field. I'm just trying to understand.
Mr. Vice Chair, I guess I'm trying to understand a little bit too here to get clarity. If biological material is collected, if the kit is utilized to collect biological material, that kit is evidence. If a partial kit is utilized, that is still evidence. There will be, in the process of identifying kits that have not been submitted to the laboratory, kits utilized in the collection of evidence. If pieces of the kit have been utilized in the evidence collection and are removed from the kit, that might be difficult to identify, but I don't have an answer for that one.
Yeah, that's what I'm struggling with, too. Thank you, Oren. Any questions for Oren from the committee? Seeing none. Dean Williams, I know you're just there for questions, but is my understanding of the difference or what evidence is it faulted? And please clarify. Don't hesitate.
No, I think that for the record, this is Dean Williams. I'm the special assistant with the Department of Public Safety. I think what the all of this issue in regards to figuring out what exactly evidence is in the sexual assault kits and counting that it was part of the, you know, clarifying attempt. From our perspective, we think the language is really relatively clear. in terms of what we're trying to count if, in fact, the bill passes. And it's a good effort from our perspective because we don't know if there's a problem and to what extent there might be a problem. But if there is one, even a small one, we should know that, and then we should work on a plan to develop it. So from our perspective, the language seems very clear. I think we know what we're dealing with in terms of untested kits. And if there's evidence in a kit, as Mr. Dim said, there may be very good reasons why they weren't tested. But we should still know the extent of what that is. We still should do a hand count, do an audit. That's what other states have done. Makes perfect sense to us. And so we're supportive of the effort for those reasons.
And Dean, if I could, just to follow up, I know you were likely talking about the entire bill, but specifically you were talking about the new definition that we have in version ECHO on page 2, lines 10 through 16. I just want to put that on the record so that I understand, you know, we're all on the same page.
You know, I discussed the what was going to be added with the sponsor, and I think that all of that helps clarify exactly what we're talking about. And so I'm very comfortable with what the definition is, and so we're good with that. And we know, I have a good sense of, and we have a good sense of what that means. So we're good with the new definition, sure.
Okay, thank you, Dean. Any other questions? Representative Grunberg has a question.
This is really a question for the sponsor, if I may.
Oh, Representative, yeah, well, thank you for being there to answer questions. Dean, if you would, stand by in case something else comes up. Representative Grunberg has a question for the sponsor.
Yes, I don't want to delay the bill or anything, but just for you to look, folks. It may very well be, I don't think you need subsection C, that a few words additional in subsection D would do it, and it would eliminate a little verbiage, and I'll just leave that at.
A follow-up question for the sponsor. Where does this bill go after it leaves here?
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. It has two additional committee referrals to the Judiciary and then the Finance Committee.
Okay, so we can work on that one, Representative Grunberg, in Judiciary if we choose to move the bill. Okay, great.
And if you, through the Chair, if maybe you can look at some how we can do that with an amendment or something. Thank you.
Representative Tallarico?
That kind of answered my question for me, so
okay.
Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you for the questions and for the presentation on the bill. What we'll do is we're going to move to public testimony if there's no more questions for the sponsor or the experts. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. First up is Jessica Claire, is it? Planned Parenthood, Northwest.
Yes.
Jessica, if you would, state your name, and if you would, spell it, and it's a little different, and tell us who you represent and give us your testimony.
Absolutely. Good morning. Thank you, Chairman Lynn and other members of the committee for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Jessica Claire. My last name is spelled C-L-E-R, and I am the Alaska Public Affairs Manager at Planned Parenthood Votes Northwest and also a nearly lifelong Alaskan and current resident of Anchorage. And I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 117 on behalf of the sexual assault survivors in our state who are waiting for closure and justice. There are estimated 400,000 to 500,000 untested sexual assault examination kits in the U.S. This not only means that sexual predators can evade justice and reoffend, but it also leaves thousands of sexual assault survivors without closure. In a state with such tragically high sexual assault rates such as Alaska, it is crucial that all rape kits are collected, submitted, and tested in a timely manner. House Bill 117 would begin the process of addressing the backlog. Today, the state does not track or monitor how many rape kits have been at testing facilities or in police storage. We need to know how many kits are sitting on shelves waiting for analysis. Every day that a kit goes untested is one more day that a sexual assault survivor goes without closure or justice. This bill will give law enforcement, the public, the information we need to tackle untested rape kits in Alaska. We may be one of the few states with only a handful of kits awaiting analysis, but we very well may not be. It is crucial that we know that information if we want to take action. States and cities that have taken steps to address the backlog in their forensic facilities are seeing significant gains for their efforts. Of the tens of thousands of old kits finally being analyzed throughout the country, cities and states have been identifying perpetrators in the National DNA database and are steadily making gains in indicting and prosecuting these individuals. Alaska needs to follow their lead. I urge you to stand up for justice and support this bill, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Jessica. And yes, I agree that we definitely have to deal with his backlog. It's a terrible thing. So, yeah, I don't see any questions at this point. So we're going to go to Nancy Porto. And I want to say for the record that Representative Vasquez has just joined us. Nancy, if you would spell us, give us your name and tell us who you represent and give us your testimony.
My name is Nancy Porto. Porto is spelled P-O-R-T-O. And I am testifying as an individual to represent myself. So good morning, members of the committee. Thank you for letting me speak today. This coming Easter marks a two-year timeline from now in the time that I experienced a sexual assault. Although I went to the hospital and the police as soon as I was able and fully consented to a full rape kit examination, the kit has still not been fully processed. I am still waiting on the biological DNA evidence portion of my exam. The event was very traumatic for me because I was fully asleep before it happened, intoxicated, and I had a narcotic in my system that I did not knowingly take. I don't know the extent of what fully happened other than I woke terrified to feeling of being touched. I was unable to move and later learned from the forensic nurses that there was a drug in my system that I did not take. On top of that, the man was and continues to be my sister's boyfriend. I was living with them at the time. This event has destroyed my family, slowed my college education with extreme difficulty, and forced me into a position of having more responsibility than I could handle alone at the time. I know many other women who have experienced assault. In addition, the fact that haunts me is I have reasons to believe he may have committed crimes with others in his past. I am asking you to please support HB 117 because it can truly be a step in the right direction and give me and any other closure. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you for taking time to testify. We appreciate it. We'll go to Byron Charles from Ketchikan. Just left? Okay. Okay. So that is there, there's nobody else online, I don't believe. Is there anybody in the room that wants to testify on this? Then we're going to close public testimony at this point and bring it before the committee for discussion, debate, or action. Representative Grunberg?
If there's no discussion, would you like a motion?
Fine.
I move the E version, the ECHO version of the bill with individual recommendations and fiscal notes.
Okay, seeing no objection, the bill passes, and what we're going to do is take an at ease and sign the paperwork, and I'll pass the gavel back to the chair.
Back on the record, Charlie, very happy that your bill got passed out of committee. I totally support it, and I'll probably be doing a co-sponsor on it as soon as I can. Because of the importance of this bill, I do want to talk to you and let the people in the audience know that I want to explore the possibility of making a letter to the Budget and Audit Committee, who can maybe check into this further. I do think that this committee doesn't have the jurisdiction to do. Mm-hmm. So I support it. I think we have a real problem here and it needs to be examined before we know what to do about it. So I want to talk to you in the next several days about crafting a letter to the Budget and Audit Committee. So again, thank you for the bill. I'm glad we got it passed out.
Thank you. We're very appreciative and would love to have that conversation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And our next meeting is Thursday. We'll be considering HB 77 disability ID license and training requirements. And we're going to SB 6 daylight savings time. That should be interesting.
Nice non-controversial.
I like to do non-controversial bills here.
Mr.
Reverend Vasquez.
For the record, Representative Grunberg supports the efforts that are going to be made with regard to the HB 177 is amended, and the request been nodded of the crime lab.
Right.
And so do I support that effort.
Yes, I think we need. I'm glad we passed the bill. I hope it goes all the way through, but we also need to do more.
Yes.
Are there any other
business? Support that effort.
Yeah. Any other business come before the committee? If not, I want to thank the vice chair for taking over while I had a bill in the Senate State Affairs Committee, which passed out successfully. Thank you. Yeah, we are adjourned.